from KQED.
Welcome back to Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. A new UC Berkeley study utilizing high-speed video reveals that some hummingbirds have evolved with an eye toward fighting, not feeding. The video demonstrates how hummingbirds stab, spar, and push each other in battles over territory, and that some birds have even developed beaks shaped to tear apart the feathers of their competition. Make that competition. Joining us to discuss this 10-year study is Alejandro Rico Guevara. He is a Miller Fellow at the Department of Integrative Biology at UC Berkeley. Welcome to the program.
Hi, Michael. Thanks for having me.
Glad to have you. And we're also joined by Lisa Tell, who's professor of veterinary medicine at UC Davis and directs the UC Davis Hummingbird Health and Conservation Program. Welcome, Professor Tell.
Hi, Michael. Thanks for inviting me.
Glad to have you with us as well. And we're going to talk to Dr. Rico Guevara first about the 10-year study. But before I even get to that, this has been a whole learning curve for me. Our producer, Tina Larberg, is a major lover of hummingbirds. I've appreciated them, but I've learned a lot about what fighters they are and that there are no less than 350 species. And I want to get to this 10-year study. But first, Dr. Rico Guevara, let's talk about some other research that you did. You studied how they drink nectar, which I think is pretty important in this whole picture that we're getting, and significant. Talk about that, if you would.
Yeah, absolutely. So that's the beauty of hummingbirds, that they can be so near you and around feeders. They are ambassadors of the natural world. But when you think about what they are and what they do every day, drinking nectar is super important in their lives. Actually, the way they are, the way they fly, how tiny, it's all related to drinking nectar. So my research for all this time has focused on the mechanisms of how they actually get the nectar out of the flowers.
And they do consume about half their weight in sugar each day, which is pretty extraordinary. But these beaks that they have really actually tear out feathers, as I said in the introduction. And what we learned and what you've learned, what we've learned from you is maybe they'd even rather fight than feed.
Yeah, so the thing is that, you know, after all these years studying how they drink, we had clear expectations about how the bills should work. And when you think about it, they are squeezing the nectar so many times a second, you know, like thousands sometimes, at a day. So they are wearing the tongue a lot. So the soft beaks, the spoon-shaped bill tips are really helpful for getting the nectar out of the flower. But then we discovered these species in which only the males have these weird, bizarre structures in their bills. And the question is why? So we started, you know, going through all the hypotheses, and we ended up filming them with high-speed cameras, and we discover what they do when they're actually, you know, getting together, and all you can see with your bare eyes is a blur. But when you slow it down, then you see that they're actually, you know, biting and stabbing, and then you relate that to these bizarre beak tips, which are, you know, like little daggers, miniature.
They're serrated, right?
Yeah, so the serrations.
They're like shark teeth.
Look like teeth, right? They're not teeth because it's not bone or the laying these structures. It's just keratin from the beak. But they function as teeth in the way that they increase traction. So as you mentioned, to tear the feathers apart, to pluck feathers in their fights and so on.
These are not the hummingbirds of poetry, unless you exclude D.H. Lawrence, who wrote about them in this terrifying way that almost makes you think about Blake's The Tiger of Fearful Symmetry or something along those lines. I mean, they're pretty ferocious creatures, even though they're beautiful to watch.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. If I was, you know, a hummingbird size, I wouldn't be near these guys.
And also very aggressive. And the women fight too, right?
Yeah, and that's very intriguing because all hummingbirds fight, you know, including females and males. Males do more fighting because they want to fight for reproduction as well as for flowers. But all species fight and all hummingbirds fight. Then why only some species, and especially the males in those few species, have weapons and most of them don't? That's a huge question.
Well, this is maybe why the Aztecs considered them linked to the god of war. There's a kind of sexual selection here as opposed to natural selection. A lot of competition going on for mates, and that involves some pretty fierce fighting too?
Yeah, absolutely. So the reproduction systems that they have vary a lot. Some of them have these places that are called leks, and they're like singles bars. So a lot of males get together in a single spot. They start singing and fighting for a place where to sing. And then the females go to those places and pick the best male to reproduce, and they then move on. So these fighting assemblages are all around reproductive success, and that's why they fight.
But they fight over territory, too, and over nectar, don't they?
But then other species, the way they reproduce is just by holding a really nice territory with a bunch of flowers that are attractive for females, and they're basically trying to seduce their partners by having these huge, like, territories with a lot of resource for their mates.
These are fascinating creatures. In fact, they have the highest metabolic rate among vertebrates, and they specialize in hovering, which is why they're being studied for their aerodynamics. And they're important also to the ecosystem. And Lisa, tell us, if you would, about what we're doing to keep them, because they're endangered.
So one of the things that we're really looking at is, trying to evaluate overall what their health status is, so trying to assess what diseases they're prone to. Also really establishing kind of some normal baseline information about hummingbirds, kind of like people. You know, when you go to the doctor, you might have some blood taken, and we'll assess that blood for whether or not there's inflammation. Other things we're looking at is exposure to toxins, so things like heavy metals and pesticides. And we're just trying to establish what is a baseline for the population that currently exists so that over time we can monitor what is a threat to them.
We're talking about hummingbirds, and there's some new research out of UC that shows that they, one of the producers said, fight more maybe for nookie than nectar, but there is a lot of fighting going on, and some of you may indeed have questions about hummingbirds. We're talking with Lisa Tell, and we're also talking with Alejandro Rico Guevara, and maybe thoughts that you have, certainly join us. Our toll-free number is available to you. It's 866-733-6786. We welcome your calls and any questions you might have or any observations you may have about hummingbirds. There are, as I said, about 320 species out there, mostly in the Americas. You can also join us by emailing us, forum@kqed.org, or going to our website, kqed.org/forum, and click on the segment, or tweet us. Our Twitter handle is @KQEDForum. Lisa Tell, why should we care about hummingbirds?
Well, I think there's a lot of reasons why we should care about hummingbirds, but I think one of the big things is they're a really good indicator of our ecosystem health. They're pollinators, they're insectivores, they're dependent on water resources, they are sensitive to climate changes, and so for all those reasons, it's great for us to be able to monitor them and keep them so that they can be ambassadors for younger generations to really care about what we're doing to the planet. I think they're great from the standpoint that they're urban wildlife. So, you know, people don't have to go to Africa or to South America to see this incredible wildlife. They're really little jewels, and I think people get very fascinated with them. But it's a good way to connect people with nature and the health of our planet.
Should people be feeding them all year round?
So in regards to people feeding them, what we recommend is if people have a green thumb, which is great, they can plant plants that bloom all year round. Native plants are really great. And so that's what we advise. But if people really want to use feeders, then we advise that in Northern California, there are populations of hummingbirds. So the Anna's hummingbirds are here year round, but it's really important to keep those feeders really clean and to make sure that all the components of the feeder can be properly taken apart, cleaned, disinfected, and then put back together.
No mold in there. I mean, you don't want any mold in there, obviously, but
you don't want any mold in there. I always say, if you wouldn't drink it, then we don't want the hummingbirds to drink it.
Well, there's a local hummingbird, Allen's hummingbird. It is climate endangered, and Audubon has listed that species as a concerned species, but there isn't necessarily overall a decline in the population. It's, let me ask you to talk about this, Lisa. It's similar to bees and colony collapse syndrome.
Yeah, that's the way we're looking at it from the standpoint that, you know, their hummingbirds are avian pollinators, and we think monitoring them long-term so that when you have something like colony collapse syndrome, that you have the baseline so that you know where to go. And hopefully, you know, sometimes it's multifactorial as to what's causing the issue, but at least you have something to start with. In regards to the Allens, yes, we, you know, they are listed by Audubon as being climate endangered. The thing that's hard with hummingbirds is they're small, and also being able to track their numbers and their movement is really difficult. And so, you know, trying to develop techniques in which we can do that on a wider scale is really important.
And if you've just joined us, we're talking about new research on aggression in hummingbirds with Alejandro Rico Guevara, and he's a Miller Fellow at the Department of Integrative Biology at UC Berkeley. He's lead author of Shifting Paradigms in the Mechanics of Nectar Extraction and Hummingbird Bill Morphology. And we also have Lisa Tell with us, professor of veterinary medicine at UC Davis. She directs the UC Davis Hummingbird Health and Conservation Program. We're going to go right to your calls here. Let me go to a couple of questions first and comments from listeners. Ellen writes, I've seen hummingbirds' bodies slam each other by the feeder at the end of long swooping dives. I could even hear the impacts of their bodies. Is this true, or was I misunderstanding what I was seeing? I've only seen this once or twice, and I've been watching for years. Alejandro Rico Guevara?
Yeah, so it's hard to tell. So they do dive displays, and they usually perform them very high and near high perches. So they look for branches on top of trees, and they do the dive displays there. They could potentially attempt to do it near a feeder, especially if there is another individual there. So they do these mostly for reproductive purposes, trying to court females. So they're called courtship displays. And if they miscalculate, that it's possible that they could hit a feeder, but I haven't seen that before.
And Lisa Tell, Alyssa wants to know, do Anna's hummingbirds only sing while seated? I heard that once, and I'm not sure if it's true.
I didn't hear the question completely.
Do Anna hummingbirds only sing while seated?
Yeah.
That is S-E-A-T-E-D, not S-E-A-D-E-D.
So they do have a vocalization that they make when they're sitting or perching on a branch, but they also do make noises with their tail, which people think is a vocalization, but Chris Clark has actually done the research to show that that's a sound that's made with the tail feathers.
All right. We're getting answers to your questions about hummingbirds and getting your calls on here, too. And our first caller is Ennis. Ennis, join us. You're on the air.
Hi. Thanks for taking my question. I've been watching hummingbirds most of my life, so I just recently noticed that this display that they do when they change their colors. I've seen them sit on a branch and be an iridescent color, and then all of a sudden turn it to a bright red or a dark color, and I assume that's for displaying to the opposite sex, but I've never heard anybody discuss how they do that, flex their feathers or what they do.
No, they're like chameleons almost. Alejandro Rico Guevara?
Yeah, sure. So what happens is that they have iridescent feathers. What that means is that they change color depending on the angle of the light, the incident light. So when you see, they prefer to orient the displays, so orient their bodies towards the sun in a way that the reflection hits whatever they are displaying towards. So in this case, if there is a female, they ensure that those huge gorget feathers, or, you know, these beautiful red and purple colors, are the brightest in front of the female. So when you see them from an angle, when they would change color because they are moving in a, you know, like back and forth fashion, and that would change the color depending on the angle of the sun.
And we thank Ennis for that question. Let me get as many of you on as we can. We'll go next to Napa and welcome Charlie. You're on the air.
Hi, thanks for taking the call. I observed a resident male on my property, and another guy showed up, and they started battling, but they would go up and come down engaging their talons like the raptors. You see the raptors come down, and just before they hit the deck, they would break. And they did this just one time. And I guess a guy learned this male was pretty tough. What do you think about that one?
Professor Rico Guevara?
Yeah, absolutely. So I've only seen these ones, and it's really fascinating because what happens is that different species of hummingbirds have different fighting strategies. So the ones with the long beaks prefer to spear. The ones with shorter beaks prefer to engage their feet, like as you mentioned. So we have only one high-speed video that shows how they actually collapse the talons and go down, but we couldn't follow it all the way to see what happens. But, yeah, it's just like raptors. That's right.
Let me thank Charlie for the call. Actually, Sonia wants to know, she says, when I see two hummers zooming in formation, is this a mating dance or territorial aggression?
So they chase each other all the time. If you are seeing them flying together, they're probably one after the other, not like actually, you know, like displaying information like other birds.
Another caller joins us from Sonoma. Cynthia, welcome. You're on the air.
Yeah, hi there. Thanks for taking my call. I'm participating in the Cornell Lab feeder watch, so I have all these numbers written down, and I'm wondering why sudden drop-off in the hummingbirds at my feeders, which I do keep very clean. I take them apart. So as far back as November, I was getting 15 or 10 at my feeders, swarming around them all the way through about January 1st, and now nothing, or maybe one or two. I talked to a man at Wild Birds Unlimited, and he said, well, they simply prefer to get little insects this time of year to make that slurry with natural nectar and pollen from flowers. But I can't believe the sudden drop-off.
Lisa Tell, can you shed some light on her question?
Oh, sure. So we actually did a study where we're using radio frequency identification technology to look at populations of birds at feeders. And we definitely noticed that here in Northern California also. And so part of the insect component, it's true that during the time that females are breeding, they are actually gathering a lot more insects as opposed to visiting the feeders often. And so they're spending more of their time foraging, trying to get that protein source for their offspring. But the other thing that we are wondering about is we have another colleague who's in the middle of the state who is down towards Yosemite, and she says actually January is the time that she has the highest number of birds. And so one of the horticulture plants that hummingbirds will visit are manzanita. And in that area, the manzanita is typically blooming. So one of the questions we have is whether or not there's more of kind of a local migration towards food sources that are relatively more abundant at certain times of the year. And then the birds will come back more towards like March, April. That's when their numbers will start rising again, and they'll return to an area in which they'll be breeding in.
Now, there's a couple of questions that are appropriate here. Bjorn wants to know, how far do Allen's hummingbirds migrate, and is there a permanent local population? Lisa Tell?
So it depends on the area for California as to whether or not there's a permanent population. So in Southern California, we are seeing that there is a permanent population, as opposed to Allen's hummingbirds in Northern California are typically coming from the southern region, and then they will so they'll come to Northern California to breed, and then they'll go south. In regards to their total migration distance, Alejandro, can you comment on that?
Yeah, well, depends on the individual, actually. So depending on the reserves they have been shown to, you know, travel farther and or not. The problem is that, you know, with RFID, that technology that Lisa uses is great to have small scale movements, but the technology is not there to have like miniature GPS trackers like people have used in other birds to actually track their migration.
And Heather wants to know, where do hummingbirds nest and where do they go when it rains and at night? Alejandro Rico Guevara?
Yeah, it's amazing that I wondered about this all the time, because you see these heavy rains, and you know, you've been talking about this in the program before, and they just, you know, pick a nice branch and then they just are super hardy and stay there, you know, like with the cold and with the rain. So they don't have like special shelters high up in the Andes, for instance. I've encountered them in caves and, you know, little crevices. But, you know, they can also stay in the vegetation, you know, like under a leaf or, you know, whatever is, you know, protected. But they are just very hardy.
And again, Alejandro Rico Guevara is Miller Fellow at the Department of Integrative Biology at UC Berkeley. And a listener wants to know, let me go to you on this, Alejandro, is there a sharp beak, is her beak sharp enough to fend off a neighbor's invasive bird-killing cat?
I think they know that claws and teeth are like definitely from a larger animal would be, you know, hard to fence. So I don't think they try that.
Well, if you've just joined us again, we're talking about new research on aggression in hummingbirds. Alejandro Rico Guevara is the lead author of Shifting Paradigms in the Mechanics of Nectar Extraction and Hummingbird Bill Morphology. And Lisa Tell, also with us, is professor of veterinary medicine at UC Davis and directs the UC Davis Hummingbird Health and Conservation Program. And this is a fundraising period for KQED Public Radio. We certainly want you to participate in the fundraising part of supporting this local radio station. Where else do you hear this kind of research on hummingbirds now on the radio or elsewhere? For more information about how to support us, how to support KQED, simply go to kqed.org. I'm Michael Krasny. And I'm going to go to some more calls here. Let me thank Cynthia for her call, and let me go to a caller in Santa Monica. Jenny, you're on the air. Good morning.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I was calling because I lived in Panama for 4 years and used to take trips up to the volcano area in Boquete, and we would see these hummingbirds that were the size of bumblebees. And I've never been able to identify them in research and books and online. I was wondering if you might know what they are.
Can either of our guests identify these small hummingbirds for us?
Well, I haven't been in the place you mentioned, but you should look into like Celasphorus scintillata, for instance. That's one species that, you know, the distribution could match the area that you described. Most of my experience is actually in South America, not Central America. So, yeah.
They're all over the Americas. That was in Panama. But here's John who writes, let me go to you on this, Lisa Tell. He says, I was amazed to see a praying mantis attack a hummingbird and eat its brain.
Yes, there was that incredible photo that was posted a bit ago where it was a male praying mantis that had captured a hummingbird, and the hummingbird was suspended. So one of the questions is whether or not those hummingbirds are actually compromised in some way, which allowed the praying mantis to actually capture it, or whether or not the praying mantis is just quick enough and stealth enough, especially a lot of times you'll see those images of praying mantises coming down off of feeders. But certainly that has been documented.
And here's a caller from Mill Valley. Mike, you're on the air on Forum. Morning.
Why the local hummingbirds, some of them actually nest in the winter instead of in the spring like the other birds?
Do they nest in the winter, Lisa Tell?
So hummingbirds, actually the Anna's hummingbirds in our area, they'll start nesting potentially even in December and January. And so that's about the time that they'll start nesting. And then they can nest all the way into what we believe will be maybe even as late as July based on the chicks that are coming out of the nest. So some birds might not only have one clutch, but they actually might have multiple clutches. So they might raise multiple sets of two hummingbird chicks throughout the season.
And let me thank the caller. And this is a question really to grapple with, I think, Alejandro Rico Guevara. Pete wants to know, do hummingbirds think faster than we do, or does our conscious experience slow things down?
That's a fantastic question. So we have been trying to study how fast they can see, because what we are seeing in these videos is that they fence like incredibly fast, so they are able to react to each other advances in a superb amount of time. So the fact that we are not seeing that they have faster like vision abilities, so this is called flicker fusion rate, then may suggest that they're actually able to process the same amount of frames per second that we get just faster in their minds. So there is, you know, like a future avenue of research there for sure.
There's another question from Steve in Petaluma. Steve, you're on the air. Welcome.
Hi. I have a vet who is a bird expert who consults all over the country, and he has cautioned me that the only sugar that should be put into feeders is from corn. You shouldn't use any other sugar but corn sugar.
Lisa, tell this vet, from your veterinary perspective, speaking sense with that.
So in regards to the sugar, what we recommend is actually the typical sugar cane processed sugar, so the white sugar that is going to be most similar to the types of sugars that are going to come from flowers. And the dilution is also very important. So typically what is recommended is you use one part sugar to four parts water, and you don't want to use it more concentrated or less concentrated due to some physiological things that could happen as a result of that. We also recommend that people don't use things like honey, because honey actually can harbor some bacteria that normally are not a problem for people but can be a problem for infants and for hummingbirds. And you don't want to feed them or use the raw sugar, because the raw sugar does tend to have a higher iron content, and there has been documented as a health issue of iron deposition in hummingbirds' livers.
Yeah, that's good advice. Also add to that, Daniel writes, not only to avoid honey, but he says don't feed hummingbirds red dye, color, nectar, or honey in water, because mold forms. We're back to mold there. And if you've just joined us, we've been talking about hummingbirds, new research on aggression in hummingbirds, with Alejandro Rico Guevara and with Lisa Tell. And Ken sends us a joke, and I always favor a good joke to end a program. Ken says, why do hummingbirds hum? They don't know the words. We'll conclude on that. Thank you both for joining us. It's good to have you aboard. Thank you, Alejandro Rico Guevara. Thank you.
Thanks so much.
And thank you, Lisa Tell.
Thank you, Michael. Really appreciate you having us.
And thank you, our listeners, and for all of us here at KQED Public Radio, I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation.